don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on December 4th, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel interviews Luke Mayville of the recent successful campaign to expand Medicaid in Idaho to find out about the distributed organizing strategy that led to statewide victory at the ballot box. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Rachel Buechelman. Here with me is the usual lead host, Bill Humphrey.
Hi.
Hi. And today we are talking to Luke Mayville, co-leader of Reclaim Idaho, the group that kind of spearheaded the Idaho Medicaid expansion ballot initiative. Hi, Luke. Welcome to Arsenal for Democracy.
Hey, Rachel. Hey, Bill. Thanks so much for having me.
So let's get right into it. Can you kind of explain the process of getting Medicaid expanded in Idaho?
Well, the process, let's see, it was an uphill battle from the very beginning because what we did was we put it on the ballot as a citizens initiative. And in Idaho, as many places, that requires gathering a lot of signatures. And in Idaho, it was especially difficult because several years ago, the legislature deliberately worked to make it all but impossible to get something on the ballot. They were upset in part because a series of really important education referenda had been put on the ballot and had succeeded and had rolled back what I think was a real, you know, pretty regressive education agenda on the part of the superintendent of state public schools. And that was called the repeal of the Luna laws. And it's this great democratic, small D democratic episode in Idaho political history that a lot of people still remember very fondly. But one of the results of it was that the Idaho legislature decided to make it very difficult to put things on the ballot. They mandated that any citizens initiative movement not only needs 6% of signatures from everyone in the state, of all registered voters in the state, but that you also get 6% of registered voters from 18 different legislative districts. So you have to carefully, you know, design a strategy of how, in this vast rural state, of how you're going to get out into 18 out of 35 legislative districts, how you're going to cover at least half of the geography of the entire state and gather thousands of signatures from 18 different communities. So that's what we had to do. And a lot of people in the beginning thought that it was nearly impossible to do it, but they believed in it nonetheless because Medicaid expansion is such an urgent issue that affects so many people's lives. And maybe we could talk a little bit more about that side of the urgency. But a long story short is that we were able to put together a grassroots campaign that not only got the 56,000 signatures that we needed, which was 6% of all registered voters, we were also able to, you know, not just qualify 18 districts, but qualify 21 districts. So we qualified well over half of the districts in the state. And that required putting together local teams of passionate volunteers all over the state, including in towns of, you know, 2,000 people, where we had, you know, teams of volunteers who were going door to door collecting signatures and up and down across the entire state. So that was the basic process of how we put it on the ballot. And then from there on, we had an entirely new and arduous campaign to convince the majority to vote for it. I could talk more about that as well.
Let's go into the results and kind of what you feel this means for the political landscape in Idaho and maybe perhaps future healthcare issues.
We needed, in order to pass Medicaid expansion into law, we needed just a simple majority, 50% plus one vote. We ended up with over 60% of the vote. There were two other states this year that put Medicaid expansion on the ballot for the first time, Nebraska and Utah. I believe they got 53% and 54% of the vote. They both won as well. We, for a number of reasons that we can speculate about, we were able to break the 60% mark, which was more than just about anyone expected. It was really pretty extraordinary. Of the counties, of Idaho's 44 counties, there were 35 counties where a majority of people voted for Medicaid expansion. And just to drive home how surprising that was, there's a county, for example, called Bear Lake County that's in the far southeastern corner of the state. Hillary Clinton received, I think, 8.5% of the vote in Bear Lake County. And Medicaid expansion won the majority of the votes. So if you compare, and this isn't necessarily the best comparison to make, but if you were to compare that election to ours, that's about a 40 plus point swing in favor of Medicaid expansion. What this means for healthcare in Idaho, what it means for the politics of Idaho. I think one thing that's important is that a number of people along the way who we would meet, who we would, you know, recruit to get involved in the campaign, they would say some version of, you know, well, this is at least Medicaid expansion. It's not everything we want in the healthcare system, but at least it's a small step in the right direction. And I would always try to push back against that way of talking about it, because the reality, I believe, is that it's not a small step in the right direction. It's really a giant leap in the right direction, because it would bring $400 million into Idaho every single year from the federal government. For the last 6 years, Idaho has been leaving at least $400 million of federal dollars, has been rejecting that money. And for a small state, that's an enormous sum of money. And over 10 years, that's $4 billion coming into the Idaho economy. To give people a sense of the scale, you know, the current Idaho Medicaid program is only about, I think it's only about $1.2 billion per year. So by adding on an extra $400 million, it's growing it by an enormous amount. You know, if you scale up to larger states and talk about Medicaid expansion, if Texas were to expand Medicaid, which they have not done, they would cover 1 million people with healthcare. And it's not like unreliable, crummy healthcare. And it's not even, you know, the kind of frustrating policies that some people find on the state exchanges through Obamacare. It's traditional Medicaid, and that means quality, reliable care without premiums, without deductibles, either free or nearly free. So it makes an enormous difference in people's lives. And so in Idaho, I talked about the sheer numbers of federal dollars being brought in, but it's at least 62,000 people who simply did not have access to affordable health care before will now get reliable quality coverage. So that's the big victory in terms of, you know, improving people's lives and just the raw healthcare victory. In terms of the changing Idaho politics, this is something maybe we could dig a little more deeply into. This is something that I'm still processing, but I think it's an enormous change. When we first got started, so many people, when we floated this idea, hey, maybe we're going to launch a statewide Medicaid expansion campaign, they said, oh, you can't do that. That's Medicaid is not popular. Medicaid is seen as a welfare program. The majority of people in Idaho view welfare negatively, and therefore they view Medicaid negatively, and that's why we haven't passed it. That's why it hasn't worked, and why we've gone 6 years now, and Medicaid expansion has been available, but Idaho has turned it down because it's simply not popular. And our gamble all along was that, no, that's fundamentally wrong. It's not popular only among legislators and only among a really narrow part of the population. If you get this out of the legislature and you bring it directly to the people, the Medicaid program itself is extremely popular, and Medicaid expansion is a popular idea. We turned out to be vindicated in that. The resounding success of the vote, the enthusiasm of all the people who came out to help collect signatures. And I think people are still trying to, you know, take in and process that result. It shakes up in a basic way some of the ideological assumptions people have about Idaho and Idahoans.
I know, speaking for myself, it was the first time I really stepped into political organizing and activism. Was that a common narrative that you heard throughout the campaign?
Well, thank you, Rachel, for all the work you did, by the way. it was incredible to have you involved at the local level, and I remember you being involved very early on as well. So that was really powerful. I think, to your question, yes. And that's one of the things I've been reflecting on that's really exhilarating about, you know, this past month and about the victory. One of my worries is that, look, we brought in all these people into politics for the first time. If we lose, or especially if we lose badly, a lot of those people might give up, at least for the time being. And, you know, they'll think of this whole experiment in politics as not really having been worth it. And so one of the really exhilarating things is just the idea that all these people who got involved and invested their hope in the political process for the very first time through this campaign were able to enjoy that victory. And my sense is that pretty much anyone who invested a lot of energy into this campaign had a very positive experience, watching those results come in, and those people are likely to remain engaged for the foreseeable future. And that could be transformative for Idaho politics, I think, in the long run. But to answer your question more directly, yes, it was certainly the case that there were a lot of people around the state who were getting involved for the first time. I would say the most common story, it wasn't that someone went from being completely apolitical to diving in to our campaign, but it was the case that people went from being, you know, maybe pretty engaged in following politics, maybe in attending some meetings, whether it was, you know, Democratic Party or Indivisible or DSA or any League of Women Voters, any number of other groups. You know, they're kind of attending things, but sort of on the sidelines. And this was the first time they really jumped in and started doing that, these basic deeds and going out and doing the work that's involved in winning campaigns, going door to door, getting signatures, making phone calls. It's what I really think of as the essence of politics, which is confronting people directly. Well, maybe confronting is the wrong word because that sounds a little antagonistic, but approaching people directly who are most often perfect strangers and who you have every reason to believe either isn't on your side or might even be against you in a lot of areas, and attempting to persuade them and get them involved in what you're doing. That really, I think of that as the essence of what politics is. And for so many people, this was their first time, even if they had kind of dipped their toe in the water by joining a group already and attending some meetings and things. This was the first time that they really went out and did the work of politics. And that was true in the cities, and it was true in small towns. And the last thing I'll say to that is, one of the inspiring things is you know, with some of the older people, they would say, no, this isn't my first time being involved, but it is my first time being involved since the 60s. Or they would say, you know, since I was in college or something. So we were activating people for the first time, but we were also reactivating people who hadn't been engaged for a generation.
I had a question about the signature gathering teams, because you mentioned that you had to do that regional distribution across the state to get the signatures. Were those people, you know, in those towns, like you said, of, you know, 2,000 people or however many, were those people generally that the organizers, the signature gatherers, being recruited from those areas directly, or were you sending people, you know, from the Capitol or wherever? Because I know that's been sort of a big organizing debate, especially on the East Coast. And in the South, is this sort of tendency to kind of parachute people in from other locations, and that's not sometimes effective?
That's a really important question. We did very little of parachuting people in. Well, I think in this respect, we really struck a balance. We haven't talked yet about maybe what I should have started with in the first sentence. Maybe the most successful element of our campaign was the big green camper called the Medicaid Mobile. We started with this old camper that my friends Garrett and Emily Strizich, who started the entire campaign with me, they had bought this camper for $1,500, so they already owned it, and they decided to give it over to the cause, more or less. And we painted it a bright green. We just spray painted it in my mom's backyard in the far northern part of Idaho, and then we put the words in big bold letters, Medicaid for Idaho, across the side of it, as if Medicaid were a candidate for statewide office and traveling all around the state. And we started the whole campaign by blasting out on social media as loudly as we could that, look, we're doing this, using email newsletters and encouraging people to send them around and trying to make them go viral in people's inboxes. And by doing that, we were able to get some new contacts from elsewhere around the state, parts of the state we didn't know. When we started, by the way, we knew close to zero people in Boise, which is the major population center of the entire state. We started in a small town way up in the north, 9-hour drive away from Boise. So we blasted out the information, and what we did was we launched a 20-town tour where we drove this camper to anywhere where there was any interest in meeting with us, you know, from any local people. And sometimes there were a few places that were, you know, a little more population centers or the place that we were just kind of fascinated by, that we stopped in even if there was no one to meet us. And then we'd just go to a grocery store parking lot and start talking to people about healthcare. But we traveled all around the state. And through that experience, and I'm getting to your, I'm trying to, in a roundabout way, trying to answer your question, Bill. But through this experience of this first summer tour, which was still like 5 months out from when we even filed the ballot initiative, we started meeting really passionate people locally who desperately wanted to see this happen. Sometimes because they were just really idealistic, sometimes because they or someone in their family was directly affected by it. And what we did was we tried to, you know, really stay in touch with them. And then when it came time to decide to go on the ballot initiative, one of the very first things we did before we officially filed it, we just got on the phone and had a lot of really serious phone calls with with these people, these passionate people we had met all around the state. And we said, look, if we do this, are you in? And can you organize your local community? One of the goals early on was to say, okay, we need 18 different districts. Let's try to get commitments from people in 20 different districts. If we can do that, then we'll already have that built-in commitment. You know, of course, you could predict some people will flake away. Is just, I think, a rule of organizing that there's always, you know, you call it the flake factor. So people will always flake away, but a good portion of those people will remain committed, and then you'll be able to pick up new people along the way. So built into our model before we even launched the official campaign was commitments that were distributed across the state. You know, people organizing call this distributed organizing, the idea that you recruit and call on local people to be leaders in their own communities and you challenge them to do it. You know, you might assume from a kind of traditional political model that you can't possibly do that unless you have like $1 million to start building a statewide staff with local staff in every place. But that's not true if you have a big enough, a monumental enough cause that inspires people. Because if you're able to put out a vision of something that we can achieve together if we work hard at it, there are, in so many cases, there are people out there in all these different places, no matter how large the Republican voting majority was or how many people voted for Trump or whatever, there are going to be at least a few people who want to devote a big chunk of their lives to doing something big. And we found that to be true. So to the question of, you know, do you parachute people in or do you rely on local people? I would say for the most part, we relied heavily on local people with the one big caveat that in order to find those local people and recruit them in the first place, we had to do a lot of driving around ourselves. Throughout the next, you know, 18 months, as we filed the initiative, we won the petition drive and then moved towards winning the vote, we had to do quite a lot of traveling around. We usually called them tours, where we traveled around in the RV. And through those tours, we weren't parachuting in and, you know, doing all the door knocking ourselves. Instead, we were revisiting those communities and doing everything we could to reactivate local leaders and local volunteers to generate plans to go out and knock doors themselves. And all along, really trying to encourage them and give them whatever resources they needed to get the work done themselves. So we were willing, any basic organizing cost that anyone took on, we were willing to reimburse, for example. Or we were always, whenever we were driving around in the camper, we always had stacks of literature, stacks of banners, signs, yard signs, other things that we were always handing out to people to give them all the resources and advice that they needed, and try to, you know, I would try to, you know, and or others in our group would, you know, give speeches to try to just kind of remind people as much as we could how high the stakes are of this whole thing. But other than that portion of it, it was a heavy reliance on local volunteers, local leadership.
So as much as we love a happy ending, someone has to come and kind of spoil the fun. And in Idaho, that's the Idaho Freedom Foundation, kind of a dark money group that fights against progressive causes. I just read today that the Idaho Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case challenging the legality of Medicaid expansion. So what can you tell us about that?
I think I can even manage to pull off a positive spin on this. If let me try at least. So the Idaho Freedom Foundation was the group that led the opposition to our entire campaign from the beginning. They especially really started pushing against us once we got it on the ballot. I think they assumed we probably weren't going to get it on the ballot. And once we did, they led the opposition against it. One of the great achievements of our victory is that we revealed to people all over the state that the Idaho Freedom Foundation is not invincible. This is a group that routinely intervenes in, you know, primary elections, exclusively on the right side of the spectrum. They primary relatively moderate Republicans with more, you know, extreme libertarian tax cuts for the rich Republicans. And they have been extremely successful at that. And that's led to a reputation of them being perhaps the most powerful group in Idaho. We played that to our advantage. We suggested pretty clear terms that they're the Goliath of Idaho, and we're up against them. And so winning with over 60% and keeping their number down to 39.4 or something like that was just an incredible signal to be able to send to people all over the state that this group isn't quite what we thought it was. Maybe what they're mainly effective at is influencing the tiny portion of voters who vote in Republican primaries. And maybe what they're most effective at is lobbying Republican legislators, but maybe they're not very effective in the larger political arena, which is the arena of general elections, actually trying to appeal to the broad majority of people. So that's one bright side of our whole struggle with them. Now, a not so bright side, as you're mentioning, is now they're back to an arena they're more comfortable with, which is, you know, lawsuits and litigation. They filed a lawsuit. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear arguments in January. The short story is that it's extremely unlikely to go anywhere because the essence of their argument is this spurious claim that by delegating power to the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare to implement Medicaid expansion, we are somehow violating the separation of powers. And they claim that we are delegating lawmaking power to an executive agency. Our simple answer to that is no, we're not delegating lawmaking power, we're delegating implementation power. We are simply delegating the power to implement Medicaid expansion and perhaps to set standards or administrative rules related to implementing Medicaid expansion, which is the kind of power that's been delegated broadly to executive agencies in the United States ever. At the very least, that's been the regular pattern since the 1930s, when the executive agencies took a larger role in governing than they had previously had. Now, the Idaho Freedom Foundation perhaps is trying to rehash that argument because they're against pretty much everything that's happened since the 1930s. They would like to see us brought back to the kind of dog-eat-dog survival of the fittest, every man for himself world of the, you know, early 20th century and late 19th century. Ultimately, I don't really think that has as much to do with it as it's just a delay tactic, because there's not really much to the lawsuit. There's not much of a chance that any court would uphold it. I just got into some of the specifics, but the simplest reason that the court will rule in favor of Medicaid expansion is that our legislative language on our initiative is perfectly aligned with the language of 33 other states that had already implemented Medicaid expansion. So for the Idaho Supreme Court to strike down Medicaid expansion would be this enormously consequential event for the entire country, because it would suggest that Medicaid expansion all across the United States might have to be reconsidered, and that the healthcare coverage of millions and millions of people is in limbo. So I don't see that happening. And here's the bright side. When we win the court battle, in the event that the Supreme Court rules in our favor, which I'm almost certain they will, that will be yet further vindication of our cause. It will make we already collected well over the number of signatures needed. We already won by a landslide in the general election. To then be vindicated once more in the courts would put us in an even stronger position. So overall, I'm optimistic about the situation, although it is frustrating.
So the legislature meets next month. Are you worried that there's been talk that they might try to put work requirements into this implementation? Are you worried about that at all?
Yes, and in fact, that is the far greater danger than the danger emanating from the courts. In the lawsuit. The far greater danger is the legislature. And in the legislature, we face two fights. The first and most essential one is simply whether or not the legislature will fund the bill, which actually means funding one small part of it. Because, you know, one of the great things about Medicaid expansion is that the state government only has to cover 10% of the costs. The federal government covers the other 90%. And what often happens when states expand Medicaid is that by bringing in that windfall of federal dollars, they end up actually saving the state money because all of the economic gains end up offsetting that 10% that the state has to pay. But that said, just to get the program up and running, the state does have to fund 10% of the costs. So we're talking about really a drop in the bucket in terms of Idaho budgeting. It's a very small expense that would then in turn draw down a very large amount of federal dollars into the Idaho economy. So it should be a no-brainer, but some legislators will likely obstruct. And we have to work to make sure to do everything we can to make sure that's not a majority of legislators, make sure that we win that fight to get it funded. And now the second important fight is the one that you've mentioned, which is the fight over whether the legislature will allow Medicaid expansion to simply be implemented as it was written and without all kinds of modifications. The chief threat here is the modification that's called work requirements. We always call them, we try not to say work requirements. We always, if we're going to say it at all, we say so-called work requirements, because this is really tricky. That when the term work requirements is polled publicly, it tends to get high approval. And that's because you just hear that phrase and you think, oh yeah. I mean, not you or not me necessarily, but a lot of people think, oh yeah, isn't this all about working people anyway? So it makes sense that you would actually try to incentivize people to go to work in order to get their health care. Like that's kind of a reasoning that a lot of people fall into. We call them so-called work requirements because, in fact, there's no evidence that when these regulations are put on Medicaid that they actually incentivize people to work at all. The evidence is actually in the other direction, that if you really want to get people if you want to get people struggling with healthcare issues, if you want to make sure they work, you do everything you can to get them healthcare. Because when people, I mean, it's a pretty simple concept, and you know, when people are healthier, they're more likely to go and work. They're going to have the energy it takes to get into the workforce. So it's not, these things aren't good policy at all. And in fact, what they tend to do, as we've seen in the case of Arkansas, Kentucky, and other states, is that they actually, without incentivizing anyone to work, they actually just kick thousands or even tens of thousands of people off of health coverage. It's bad policy, and we're going to do everything we can to educate the public about work requirements and to lobby our legislators so that work requirements aren't connected to this new law.
So we are about out of time. So I would love to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great to chat with, especially to chat with someone who is actually deeply involved in the campaign, and to look at this not just from a perspective of policy, but also from a perspective of democracy and activism. So thank you so much.
Thanks for being here as well, Bill.
Yep, thanks. That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.